Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
And Lorraine, what about in a situation where maybe someone's down on themselves or, I don't know, had some tough situations and you just want to show you care, you want to bring in some positivity? Is there value in that situation to say good job, to try to cheer them up a little bit?
No. Sorry. But you know me well. The good job is just strengthening our neural pathways to keep saying good job when we really need to be providing feedback. The best thing you can do if you want to connect with someone at an empathic level is to identify how they feel with a, I can see you feel I can see that whatever it is has had a big impact and shaken you up a bit. If there are ways that we identify the feeling, then we've got connection. Good job is, it can be like, yeah, big deal, and especially if they're over seven, Sorry, John.
Dang.
Well, I guess kind of on this, we have a question, Lorraine, from Natalie Morgan, LMU assistant coach.
Yep.
She asks, if I want to tell someone that they took a big step and that was good, is it best for the learner for me to say that was a good step? If I don't, it feels like they aren't sure if it was good or not.
Okay. Well, my take on that is that was a good step infers, but it isn't specific enough to identify just what that good step was in order that I can repeat it. So what was involved? How did the athlete take a good step? So do you see where it needs more information? Because the possibilities are endless as to what the coach has seen as was a good step. And so personally, if I was the athlete, I'd be well pleased if I've done something that prompted being told that was a good step, but I would need to have it labelled, learn to have it identified what was good about it. And I would want to know if it was something that I've really been trying at and not just fluked it for my first time I ever gave it a go. But most importantly, I would want it, because it's clearly pleased my coach, which means I've done well and I'm getting better, I'm improving, I would want to repeat my action. So hence I would need to have the skill identified in order for me to repeat the good step. So was the good step related to a non-cognitive skill, for instance, with persistence or focus or taking a reasonable risk, or was it a volleyball skill? So did taking my big step take me out of my comfort zone? Did I draw on courage? Did I step up into leadership? Or was I attempting a new skill? All these questions need to be answered by the feedback we give. And also, just as a little careful one, good is a value judgment, and it's well-intended, but a value judgment nonetheless. And we use words like good without anything around it. We can equally be perceived as that we have the propensity then to use a value judgment of not good enough. We're growing neural pathways with whether we want to or not. So that's where we have to practice so that we get that. Remember that animation with what we're focusing on expands, and what the other one, the Hebbian law of what you focus on, what you fire together, wire together, and what no longer fires together will unwire. So that's where we need to practice what we want to say so we can say it deliberately, because we've got years of good jobs and great and awesome in us.
Right. Yeah, I've been working on it a lot since you've been gone. I still got a lot of pathways to grow. So another thing that you talked to us about is, and I think it's very common, and I'm still working on this, but when I give feedback, I'll start the statement with I. Uh-huh. I saw you improve at this. I saw you working at this. Can you talk about the harm or value of?
Okay. You just exampled then is I saw you about, you're telling the person, the athlete, who's looking to learn from you to improve, you're telling them what you've just observed, but you're not talking about them. You're talking about what you've been observing, not what they did, and the processes they've been putting on. And it's intended to be so kind. I'm so proud of you. I saw and I like the way you. And again, we're only coming back to ourselves. And I did this in a class just very recently, and the lady had picked up her pen, and I said, oh, I like the way you picked up your pen. And she had a big smile come all over her face. And so it just says how set up we are to hear nice things about it, even if they're completely empty. And so I asked her, what have I told you? Is that I like how you picked up a pen. It was completely unrelated to anything. And it's that I like is well intended, but it does cause a lot of damage. So it can confer that I'm watching you, not as a, in a very positive way. It's I'm watching you, I'm seeing you. But it says, you can say, I'm watching or I saw how you're learning to help, watching you learn and how to help you grow and take you to the next level. That's appropriate for our observation, because invariably we can let ourselves down and others down when we're observing or when we fail, when we're distracted, when we're not present. Being present is everything. And off track a bit, but we see that at playgrounds where children are just calling out, Mom, look, Dad, look, and all that. And we're usually talking to someone or even worse on our iPhone. So I saw is reaffirming, but we need what we're seeing.
What about the situation of, you know, you're with your player and it feels like it's you and them. So you say, we need to work on this.
Okay. It's again, it all comes down to the we statements. So if you were saying that we need to work on that, and you know, and there's a good culture, a good rapport, we can usually mean, well, I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about you. Whereas if it's that kind of rapport and understanding that it conveys, the language conveys, I'm here to work with you and help you, so we'll work on this together. That's a powerful statement of support, and you're not expected to do this alone. That's my job to help you as the coach or to work with you as the coach. The negativity or the absolving oneself to direct it onto others, that will trigger the threat response quite quickly. So, so for instance, a you statement, it could be, you didn't do your job, you messed up. So a you statement is better, you need to be really proud of what you've achieved is a you statement. But if it's a you statement twisted to, you didn't do your job and you've messed up, well, maybe they did and maybe they didn't, but it's an accusation and it's not necessarily a fact. Failing to identify roles played and things like that. I really am concerned. I get very, very self-conscious that I can sound nitpicking, but I promise you, I do observations in classrooms, and it's easy to see how the rise and fall of the learning and the well-being in the classroom rises and falls according to the language being used. It's quite profound.
Yeah, and I can relate to what you said with the we statements, because I feel like that's my passive-aggressive way to get my partner to work on something. I say, hey, we need to work on blocking or something.
And are you playing alongside of them doing that blocking?
No, I'm not. That's mostly their job.
No, he's never blocking.
funny about that.
Yeah. Lorraine, how does the brain respond to I or we statements versus informative statements? And I guess just to refresh the listener's memory, can you go over briefly what informative statements are?
An informative statement is free of judgments for a start. You're giving a person information. As a directive statement is language of command. And so, for instance, you might say, sit there, stand up, pick that up. For children, we say, get in the car. They're all directive statements, and again, they will invoke a threat response. We give a lot to children, but a lot not limited to children. I've certainly heard adults speak to each other in the same way. So whereas an informative statement is invitational, it doesn't sound bossy, whereas a directive statement does. And it can feel really, again, with changing our prey language, it can feel incredibly awkward when we're reframing directive statements with an informative statement. So again, useful to practice to grow neural pathways. So what I saw going on in the gym, for instance, when I was there, was someone would yell out, pick up the balls. But that's a directive. An informative statement reframe is, I can see balls over there. Now, that may sound so trivial, but when we're doing that, we're giving the athlete, they get to do their own thinking, their own decisions about their own behavior. Because directive, it can almost have a twist on it of why haven't you picked that ball up? But if an athlete, if he hears there's balls over there, oh, right, I'll go and get them. Yeah, I'm close, I can do that. Do you see the difference? It's very flimsy, but it's a very strong difference of when you're telling someone what to do, where they can make decisions about, I'll go and get that, as opposed to, oh, heck, I'm in trouble because I didn't pick it up. So the ultimate weakness of relying on directive statements is that over time, they need to be escalated in intensity. So our role is that we speak informatively and leave a space in which our learners' thinking can take place. And I've said this before, in the US, when we tell students or athletes or our children what to do, we give them only two choices. To do as told, which means to acquiesce, or not do as told, which means to rebel. And again, both situations induce the threat response, releasing public enemy number one, cortisol. We command or we guide. And even Daniel Pink says, control leads to compliance, autonomy leads to engagement.
I'm wondering, with the really high performing, really effective teachers that you've observed, what percentage of their feedback is an informative statement?
Oh, heck, there's one school I'm particularly thinking about. And, oh, golly, I would say 75 to 80%. And invariably, when it's not, it's been when we've had a new intake of teachers. And I don't mean, you know, the staff replacement, but the newer teachers have still got that highly developed, you say these nice things, or you give direction, or you tell children what to do. And they're very keen to get on board, and they're very embarrassed when there's someone around, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to say that. But certainly the numbers is very, very high. But again, the school I'm thinking of, they began this journey back in 2014, so they've really been working it. And it's also the culture there. For instance, nothing can bring this up smarter or faster than imposter syndrome. And to deal with that, they created an after-school time, because the school understands that at any time we can be triggered into imposter syndrome. So at the weekly meetings, it's just understood there's a crucible of safety, openness and trust to name feelings and responses to particular scenarios, no matter how embarrassing. And that unites the staff and reinforces their sense of belonging and connection. But again, it's from that safety to get it wrong. And it just, oh, it's like telling a child how wonderful they've wiped the bench, and they're like, I can wipe other things. And when teachers are given and parents opportunities to, it's perfectly normal and okay. They just want to improve so much deeper and quicker. But that's it. Nothing embarrasses people more when they realise Lorraine Davies is standing near them and they've been saying all the good jobs and or telling kids what to do. But I certainly... Well,
it's a really high percentage. Yeah. I mean, 75%. I'd love to strive to be able to be that informative.
Yes. The informative... Oh, golly. It's either about asking... It's Yeah, when you said that, so much of the conversation is about bringing questions to the students for their thinking, not so much telling them. That's a really big part of it. So the children are encouraged to think and come up with some other alternatives or some of their own answers, but certainly informative. I can't even imagine, actually, as I'm thinking. I'll just say very briefly, if I may, there was actually a learning took place with this, and it actually involved my granddaughter. And the teacher, my granddaughter was standing next to me, and the teacher said, "Hannah, I want you to, and I want you to do this, and then I want you to do that, and then I want you to do this." And Hannah turned on her heel to go and do exactly that. But knowing Hannah, I said, "Hannah, can you tell me what you've just been asked to do?" And she went to speak, but she had nothing. And that was a really big, really big learning for teachers, and it went through the school. Just telling isn't enough. There was hearing, but no understanding. And so we need to clarify what's been understood, and it's got to be safe for a student to be able to say, "I don't know." And so that when we tell, when give that instruction, we don't know that it's been processed or understood, and especially when there's three directions given at once, directives rather, given at once. We're in such a rush. We're in such a rush. So the informative of when you, then we can, then that can be attended to. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That applies to our own, particularly our own children.
So a lot of the feedback that athletes and students hear is from each other. So I'm wondering how you teach athletes or students to give productive peer feedback.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, peer feedback is absolutely, absolutely brilliant. I highly, highly recommend it. But I hasten to say it needs to be explicitly taught, because feedback has to be kind, specific, and helpful. So it requires explicit teaching. I highly, highly, highly recommend you begin, or anyone begin, looking at the most amazingly incredible Ron Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, and his YouTube videos or his EL education videos. And they have very specific YouTube clips on doing just that. But peer learning, again, this happens at a really top school I'm thinking of. Peer feedback, it's just normal for kids in the class and to the teacher to say, "Can you give me some feedback on this?" And again, as they've been taught about that it has to be kind, specific, and helpful. And they really thrive on that. And being with peers, it I believe it has a much more powerful impact, because there's such a sense of trust, and it's just taken as a fact, as opposed to, I've heard kids say to some teachers, "Oh, you're just being mean to me," because it's too painful to hear that there's more work required. But it's not something we should launch into with, "I just want you to start giving each other peer, I want you to give each other peer feedback." It's critical, critical for growth, but just needs to be taught really well, because we can easily get it wrong. There are rules around that.
I strongly recommend people watch that video. It's such a great, great video.
With the Austin's butterfly. I like to point out in that video, because it can be easily missed, his artwork went from what I would have thought was adorable for a five-year-old as a grandmother, but with the peer feedback, it elevated to a level of a piece of masterpieceful piece drawing, and yet the only way it got to that level was from the feedback from peers. There wasn't any adult intervention or commentary anywhere.
Lorraine, I have a question from a listener.
Uh-huh.
Aaron Mansfield asks, in high-performing cultures that you have been around, what are some things you have noticed in the way the members of the group interact or communicate with one another?
Okay. So I think I'd like to share with you an experience I had years ago, particularly that examples culture at a very high level. And when I came to the attention of Mindset Works, and that's the company co-founded by Professor Carol Dweck from Stanford, the originator of all this work, I came to their attention. And at the time, David Schweitzer was COO. He's now with Google. And David asked me if I would mind sending him my work. And I immediately fell into imposter syndrome. And thankfully, although not consciously, expressed out loud, "What if my work is crap? Because this is Mindset Works. This is Carol's backyard." And David laughed a little and said these magical words. And he said, "Yeah, it might be crap, but how great to be in a place where you can receive feedback to improve." And I just spontaneously burst into tears. I was stunned about his response that being totally crap is simply a learning opportunity. And as I cried, David said, "Yeah, that's what it's like when working in a growth mindset culture. So there was no pep talk, no fluff, no reassuring, "Oh no, I'm sure it'll be wonderful." It was a culture of that where honest feedback was just how it was. And I was later invited to be an affiliated partner with Mindset Works. So that was just dipping a toe in how we can create a culture where feedback joins people together and there's no value judgments. You're just hearing how it is and it's kind, specific and helpful. It was amazing. I don't know if that explains that, but that to me is a culture to aspire to. When there's not that reassurance of, oh, no, it's lovely.
Yeah, I like that story. Mm-hmm. Aaron has a second question. There are many non-cognitive skills that you can tie praise to. Have you noticed any non-cognitive skills that stand out that lead to more effective learning or performance than others?
Oh, I can actually do better than that. But what I would like to focus on the question was that the focus was on being effective rather than efficient. And that is so admirable because there's a huge difference. And more I see this world turning to, oh, it's efficient, it's quick, it's easy, but it's far less effective. So that's a great focus to have. I'll just tell you about the Dunedin study. It's now in its 40th year and ongoing. Began with these very, very young children and still going. And they confirm that self-regulation is the number one non-cognitive skill for personal, academic, and professional success. So it's crucial that if we observe even the slightest moment of an athlete student in coaching, in their self-regulating, it's crucial that we name in our process praise or feedback in order that they learn that self-regulation exists within them, even if in small amounts, that they can develop that self-regulation across many things. Because too often those we teach or coach are unaware that they possess any non-cognitive skills. And so when we can name the skills that we're seeing, but that's the trick of it, we have to observe what we're seeing. And it could be a whole myriad of different non-cognitive skills, but the most effective is for self-regulation, self-discipline, self-management, but self-regulation is usually what it's referred to. And so to name the non-cognitive skill, to name the process, and we have to have observed that action. So, for instance, another one for building great culture within the organization, school, gym, anywhere, is you showed a lot of compassion and empathy for Chris when you comforted her. oh, I have empathy and compassion. You imagine someone who's been told they're thoughtless and don't care or whatever. No, I've been told I've got empathy and compassion. We need to name these non-cognitive skills so we can see them, and when we see them, to feed back that that's what we're seeing. But just in terms of how much they're found in this Dunedin study, even if people are overseas, people in New Zealand where it's based will fly to them. If a person's in jail, they'll go to the jail to interview them. It is kept so incredibly strong, tight and professional that they want to see it through. But it clearly, head and shoulders, self-regulation is the strongest non-cognitive skill that will guarantee success personally and professionally, which I think is pretty powerful.
It's always a pleasure picking your brain. I know you mentioned that some of this might sound nitpicky, but just how important it is because language is so powerful. Can you share with the listeners? I remember as we were talking when you were in California, we were kind of saying, oh, what should I do this and what should I do here? And you said that should is actually kind of a buzzword or a no-no. Can you explain why?
No, should infers you've done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I should have picked that up or I should have put that down as opposed to could. Could's a word of possibilities. Yeah, I might put it down or I might pick it up or I might do that. But if you should have put that over there, there was only one way and I've really fluffed it. So it should induce a shame. And again, my first thought is, oh, I probably sound nitpicky, but it's true. It infers you've stuffed up, you've done it wrong, as opposed to it was just a possibility. You could have done it that way or you could have done it this way.
It's all come full circle. It's the perception of autonomy again, huh?
Always, 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 always. And look, just one thing I'd like to say, and I've taught this before, a sense of autonomy is not a nice to have. It's critical, critical for our mental health and well-being. It really is.
Well, it's something we're going to continue to be aware of, and you've given us a lot more to go out and practice because I know a lot of this is changing habits, and we need to bring awareness to the areas where we don't have autonomy or where we're using I statements or saying good job. So we'll get to work and we'll work on getting better, and then we'll follow up again soon. And can't wait to have you visit us again in May.
Well, I really like what you're saying, John, and that could sound like will make me happy. But what I'm saying is that I really encourage, and this is, again, the culture comes into it, of when we work together as a team, we're supporting each other. Just as the school I spoke about, where it's understood, we're just bumbling and stumbling around and we're making mistakes and we're feeling inadequate, but we support each other to strengthen each other to move forward. So anything that you're doing is when it's shared with those around you, those from the athletes to your children, to your partners, to your peers and colleagues, it's so important that we do it as a group because we normalize it to the group, not just something weird about him or her.
It's a great message to close with. Thanks, Lorraine.
Thanks, Lorraine.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, guys. I really love speaking with you. I really do. I do a bit of self-censoring of, oh, gosh, what does that sound like? But I love talking with you.
No, we love.
I've lost you.
John cut out, but he's saying all kinds of praise words.
Oh, bless you, bless you, bless you, bless you.
I didn't say good job, though.
I thank you. I bless you, John. Bless you, Bill.
All right, good night, guys.
I look forward to seeing you.